Hello, you lovely lot. Welcome to the Gadget Show podcast. I am Susie Perry.
And I'm Jason Bradbury. And a huge thank you to CEX for sponsoring today's episode.
Yeah, they make the upgrade journey so much easier. Trade in the old dusty drawer clutter.
And walk out with tech that actually sparks joy. Cameras, VR, gaming gear, phones, all properly refurbished.
And yes, a 5-year warranty on everything. That is mad value in 2025.
Head to webuy.com or maybe travel into town and visit one of your CEX stores and start the recycling revolution.
Hello, welcome to the Gadget Show podcast, the Inbox edition. This is the episode where the entire agenda is in your hands. Your questions, your tech opinions, your wins, and the occasional gadget disaster, which we love.
And we've had some really interesting stuff come in this week. Some great stories, some proper head scratchers, and a few that definitely made me feel better about my own tech mistakes.
Right, let's get straight into it. The first question is from Ben Harrington. It's for you, Jace. He says, I remember you on a previous podcast saying that you used to work on Games Master. So he wants to know, what are your favourite memories from it? And did it help lead you to getting the Gadget Show job?
Well, I tell you what, Susie, I'm going to surprise you because I had a bit of a clear out the other day. And honestly, I did not know this question was coming until you just read it. And look what I've got here.
What?
The golden joystick.
Oh! So
for those listening, I'm holding a Games Master golden joystick, which was the thing that you... you know, that you went onto the show to try and win. And I'm fortunate enough to have this golden joystick, not because I won it, because I was a researcher or a runner on the show. So I was just running around getting everyone coffee and making sure the guests were ready and things like that.
Because my friend
Tim of Utah Saints, the 90s band, him and Jez, the two members of the band, went onto Games Master and they won their round and they were given a golden joystick. And Tim knows how much I love that show, and he said you can. Well, he didn't say you can have it. He said you can borrow it. So I've had it for about three years.
When, I was going to say, when was that?
Yeah, she'd probably give it him back. So there you go. What a great question that is. My memory, just simply put, is of just working very, very hard, being very grateful for one of the first jobs I had coming out of university. My friend at the time, who was in the year above me at uni, was Dominic Diamond. He was going out with my flatmate, Mivamwe. So that's how I kind of got the job, because he kind of got his mate in to get his first job. And so I did get to experience a lot of the show because Dominic was the host, the famous presenter of the first few series. And it was just amazing. It was heady chaos. You know, I can't remember anything specific other than a few pop bands that I was kind of starstruck to be, you know, making tea for. And it was a great experience. I worked in the series when we were in the oil, what was meant to be an oil rig, but it was actually a water pumping station just outside Richmond in Surrey. But it was the oil rig in the fictional world of Games Master. So, yeah, it wasn't anything to do with me getting the Gadget Show. Because it was a long time after that I actually went to do an audition, which is how I got the Gadget Show. Maybe they looked on my CV, Suze, and thought, well, he must know his games because he worked on Games Master. It certainly wouldn't have helped, hindered my application to the Gadget Show.
Yeah, and I think, you know, when you work on a show that's kind of, I'm going to say experimental, in that you're not following a format of another show, and I would put the Gadget Show in that group as well.
Yeah.
It's exciting, isn't it? Because you're kind of inventing things and you're trying stuff out for the first time and it's fresh and it's heady, like you said. That's a really good word.
The way you described
Games Master would be actually the way that I would describe the first few series of the Gadget Show, because we did things that didn't work and we changed them and the format evolved over, I would say, like the first 3-4 series.
Yeah.
I suppose.
That was incredible experience. Great question.
Yeah, thanks, Ben. Right, another question from Tom Forsyth. Which company do you trust the least in tech right now?
That's a really good one, because obviously as a tech journalist, we have to be a little careful, because it's, you know, I don't want to be unkind or overly emotional, but I think everyone listening to this podcast might not be too surprised to know that I want Apple to work a bit harder and to maybe... You know, if they've not got a technology finessed and ready for market, then they shouldn't show it and convince us that it's ready to roll out. only to find that, you know, a year or even longer, it's still not there. By in terms of the feature set, they I'm not going to say they promised, but the feature set that they suggested would be there, the experience, the consumer experience. And I am, of course, talking about Apple Intelligence, really.
Yeah. I'm going to pick Meta here. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm going to pick Meta because, you know, their incentives have never really aligned with what's actually best for the user. They align.
Right. Okay.
I feel they align with what keeps you scrolling, what makes you addicted to the algorithm and behavioural data, produces data. And that, it's not like villain moustache twirling. That is literally what their business model is. They're not alone in this either, by the way, but I'm just picking them out. Yeah, I just if you're saying trust the least, that would be Meta for me and what I think.
It is interesting, isn't it, how a brand can go in just a few weeks or even in the course of an evening, you know, a particular event where they reveal a product that and you start to see them in a new light or behavior over a matter of weeks that shows you that maybe they're not the brand that you thought they were. And I would argue that I drive a Tesla and I'm a big fan of Elon Musk. I think he's an important historical figure, but there's no question that he has definitely changed the mind of a lot of consumers because of his involvement with the US government. And I'm not making a qualitative statement on that, or an opinion on it. I'm merely saying it's a fact that that brand suffered massively through that period. And so you could possibly put Tesla into that bracket. Certainly a lot of people I know would not buy a Tesla anymore. I'm not in that camp. I'll just put my cards on the table. I think it's an amazing car, our Tesla, but I totally understand why people have an issue with with Elon and the stuff that he does.
Here's a question from Raj Patel. Thank you so much for your question. He says, has retro officially become more fun than new tech?
I think, Raj, that it might be related to what we were just talking about, that the sort of polish on the brands and the relationships that we used to have has been somewhat dulled. And now we're in a less naive moment in our tech evolution. We sort of understand what they're in it for. You know, a lot of these startups run a business model where they offer services for free, don't they? That was Google initially. They offer services for free, and they might offer those services for a couple of years, and they're running on venture capital until they get you, and then they work out that what their business model might be, and then they start to charge. That's definitely the case for me with a lot of cloud services that have started charging me, because now I've filled my capacity up with pictures of my kids and I feel that kind of pressure to pay a monthly fee now, whereas before it was next to nothing. With retro, well, it's just fond memories, isn't it? It's fond memories because they didn't have these software as a service or cloud-based service models. You just bought a piece of hardware, you took it home and you plugged it into your telly and played Space Invaders on it. So yeah. I think there's a simplicity, Suze, to retro, which is why it feels, as you say, Raj, more fun than new tech in part.
You know what you're getting, don't you, with retro?
Yeah.
Your device is sort of complete and there's a sort of purity to it, I suppose.
And also games as well. A lot of games have pushed their luck. See, it is a thing. Like, this is real. Like the previous question about the muddying of our relationship with tech companies actually is much broader. There are so many examples, now I come to think of it, in the context of gaming. You know, the micropayments. If you've got kids, you will have fallen foul. It's likely you will have fallen foul of kids spending money that you weren't aware of on games, certainly on them on a mobile phone or a small tablet, you know. And also there's other examples in AAA titles where you wait for years and then the game is delayed, and when it comes out it doesn't work properly or it costs much more money than you expected. So these are all ways in which modern technology has somehow lost its polish a little bit, but retro just never will, because it's consigned to the glorious poetic past.
I wonder how much of it is nostalgia for our sort of age group. because obviously that is always glorious. We all need nostalgia more than ever now. It's you know, it's a certainty when you pick up the Sony Walkman, for example, and put a cassette in it and play it. You're going to love it, aren't you? Yeah, the quality is not going to be anywhere near what we've got now, but you're just going to love it from the kind of retro nostalgic point of view. New tech wants to constantly change and update, and you know what you're getting with retro. You know it works.
Yeah.
So that's just one piece, and I think it will be interesting to see what happens with the new generation, whether they like retro gadgets, whether they like the stuff that we used to play with, or is it just us because it's nostalgic?
Yeah, I mean, there was a big component. There was a big contingent in the retro gaming community, certainly represented in the events I go to, who are not of our age group. There's a lot of young sort of cosplayer type people that are really into retro just because it's damn cool. Yeah. I've got another question coming up from Luke Brennan, Susie. Luke is thinking about getting a smart lock. Should your front door ever be controlled by cloud servers, yes or no?
Luke, I think it's just subjective, really, now. Smart locks, they're so much better than they were, you know, a few years ago, that if it works for your style of house and you fancy the idea, then go for it.
There's all sorts of cool functionality that this new generation of smart cloud connected locks, or, you know, Wi-Fi connected locks, whatever you want to call them. And in reality now, the reality is that the modern generation of those locks enables you easy, convenient access to your house with all sorts of backup solutions should the battery run out. So I don't know if it's really the problem that you're maybe suggesting in your question.
Okay, thanks for that. Hannah McMillan would like to know, which retro game do you think genuinely holds up today?
That's a really, really good question. I haven't really thought about that before.
I think a lot of them do.
So when you say holds up, Hannah, I'm going to assume a kind of broad definition of that. So meaning can pull you in, you know, can let you forget your troubles and make you
and some
friends.
Maybe not just for like a one-off game, maybe that can pull you in so you sit there playing it.
Like Mario Karts?
Yeah.
Mario Karts, I mean, and not even the modern one for the Switch 2, which is absolutely incredible. Any Mario Kart game. So I could play Mario Kart on an N64, and I think you'd absolutely love it. I would say the same about multiplayer Doom. I played multiplayer Doom on the first generation Xbox at Play Expo in Blackpool a few weekends ago. And all of us that had gone to the show, me and my mates, there was about eight of us who all met there. We played it for about half an hour. We're completely absorbed by the process. It's incredible. It was an incredible experience. So that is the perfect example. Maybe the Sonic franchise.
Sonic 2, yeah, you could throw that in there.
Oh, yeah, Sonic 2, good choice.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they've thrown it out there and it still holds water, doesn't it? So that's a good one.
Yeah, I agree. I think, you know, a lot of people are experiencing Sonic 2 for the first time and not noticing that actually it's a retro title. It's just a really good playable game. Yeah, so that's a great question. I hope that we've given you some answers, Hannah. Let us know what your favourites are. I've got a question, Susie, from Adam Fletcher. Yeah. He says, how has presenting MotoGP changed since you first started?
Well, televisions aren't black and white anymore, so that's changed.
Really? Oh, my goodness.
Well, this is my 29th year, so everything has changed.
Wow.
I'm not sure whether you mean in terms of presenting or whether you mean in terms of the actual tech of motorbikes. I'll just touch on a few little things then that are different. So they used to have to wait till the bikes completely came in before they can get any data from them at all. In fact, when I first started, I'm not even sure how much data they could get. Now everything is driven by data. I mean, it's incredible, and it can be taken directly as the bike's out there. So they're working on those mappings all the time. The mappings are basically different settings for the bike, so the rider can change the settings as they'll basically calculate what they think the bike needs in terms of tires and everything else, and all the all the electronics on the bike, and as the race unfolds, the rider can change the mapping, so it might enable them to be able to open the throttle a bit more towards the end or not, depending on what the mapping is. So that those are different. The camera work is different in terms of the onboard stuff. So I think in MotoGP, their onboard technology has always been at the bleeding edge. And I think Formula One have actually copied MotoGP. So they've worked really hard on that. And they have things like little chase cams on the bikes. So the bikes are doing the filming work for you so they can film the other bikes. In terms of presentation, my talk back is completely different. I mean, it obviously back in, I started in 1997, so it would have been so different. I bet if I heard it now, I probably wouldn't be able to function with it. But the way that we deliver our pictures are so different, so much cleaner, so much crisper, the sound as well. So absolutely everything has changed in the last 30 years. I'm guessing those are the kinds of things that you're asking me about. But as we're actually talking about retro as well, I'm just thinking, okay, so what are the bikes are so different now. They are insanely different. They're all more like Formula One cars because they have so much aero and electronic aids. So they look completely different. They're much wider. You know, the downforce is different. They go really quickly. Do I prefer the bikes now or the bikes when I started? I prefer the bikes when I started because they looked so much better. And the tyres are different. You know, the technology within the tyres is so different. It's almost like a black art, literally, to know how the tyres work. But the asymmetrics that they use, the degradation involved in the tyres, it's really interesting. So the whole thing is a massive feat of engineering that just evolves. It continues to evolve, and to the point where actually the bikes now are too fast, too good almost for the tyres and the technology that the tyres have, and the bikes and the tyres have got too good for some tracks. So some tracks now seem too small because the bikes go so quick and they need bigger runoff areas and things like that. Wow. So it's all a big balance. But yeah, evolves all the time.
That's absolutely fascinating. What about the means of transmission? That's changed, right? Like the platforms that people are watching the content on.
Yeah.
How's that stuff changed?
Yeah, another good point. A lot of people multi-screening because there's different sports they want to watch at the same time, or different bike events they want to watch at the same time, or even they want to click into different cameras on the bikes, you know, so they can see different viewpoints of the race. That's changed. Multi-screening, the way that everything is delivered now obviously is different. Gosh, I mean, this is a whole another show that we could go into if we wanted to do a deep dive into this.
You started at a time when there was no social media. Now viewers can talk almost directly to the teams that they follow and the riders and make comments in real time.
Yeah, that's true. And they can vote on screen with a QR code for their rider of the race, things like that. It's much more socially interactive. You're right. And yeah, I mean, it's something I don't really think about because as with all technology, it evolves and evolves and you just, you know, become a part of it yourself. There's not really been one thing that's gone like, boom, gosh, you know, that's changed. But when I look back to how it was 30 years ago, yeah, I mean, yeah, it's very different. We can do so much more with broadcasting now. We can jump about more. And the cameras, obviously, the cameras are so different now. They're so much better than they used to be. But thanks for that question. I love talking about MotoGP, obviously, as you know, and it's nice to throw my back. I know at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm going to wake up and think of loads more different things. But just as if you asked me that question, those are things that I can think of straight away.
So we've got a tech confession from Nathan Collins, and it's this. I still use the Notes app on my phone as my main password manager, because I never truly trusted password managers. I know, he says, it's 2025 and this is a cyber criminal's dream. But once that habit's locked in, well, I just never moved. What can I do to fix this? Okay, Susie.
Well, a useful steer if you want to fix it without your brain melting. But we'd probably recommend one passport. So number one, password. It's premium. It's 50 quid a year, but it's really slick, really easy to use. And you can set up shared vaults if you've got family or work stuff that you want to organise. So if you're going to make the leap, that's going to get you off your notes app, because that is obviously not great for your passwords. You might want to look up one password. Have a look at that.
I think that's a really, really good suggestion. Yeah, I can't top that. Okay, Susie, it's your turn in the top 10's hot seat this week. I want you to give me what you think are the top 10 best-selling Apple products of all time.
Okay.
So you fire them at me, and I'll tell you if they actually make
the list. How specific have I got to be?
And where they sit. I don't know. Try me. Try one, and I'll see how it works.
Let's go iPhone.
You got the number one. Well done. The iPhone, 2.3 billion units is the total for Apple's most successful product ever. Launched in 2007, the iPhone 6 and the 6 Plus alone are estimated to have sold 220 million units by themselves. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
And apparently the iPhone makes up over half of Apple's annual revenue, even today. Yeah. From our sponsor, CEX, you can buy an iPhone 6 for 48 quid at CEX.
iPad.
So, well done, you've named the number two on our list. Very good, Susie. An astonishing 540 to 550 million units, a mere 10 million to quibble about. So we'll call it 550 million units. It arrived in April 2010, remains the world's most successful tablet family, with the standard entry iPad consistently being a top seller. And now, if you had the original iPad, or rather, if you wanted the original iPad, and you wanted to get it from CX, it would only cost you 20 quid.
Do you know, this is all amazing, because I remember when it came out and it got launched, there was a lot of questions about why do we need it?
Well, I remember our executive producer on The Gadget Show initially wasn't a fan. And I mean, I loved it. I was like, this is exactly what I need, a computer I can just put in my bag and not have to haul a laptop around with me.
Yeah, but I think that's the thing. You've got a phone, you've got a laptop. Why do we need something in between? But it you know, obviously we did, because everybody...
We definitely did, yeah. All right, next product, please.
Apple Watch.
You've named the fifth most successful product that Apple ever produced, with an astounding 267+ million units sold. A quarter of a million, more than a quarter of a million units sold. It landed with us in April of 2015. This is incredible. By 2019, Apple was selling more watches per year than the entire Swiss watch industry combined.
Really?
And yes.
It's its 10th anniversary this year.
Apple Watch Series 1, that's the first Apple Watch, Susie, would only cost you 45 quid at CX. But you might want the more feature-rich Series 11, which is the latest one.
Yeah.
And that starts at £280 at CEX, and the retail price would be £369.
So, MacBook Pro.
You've named the seventh most popular product that Apple sell. They started selling MacBook Pros in January of 2006, the original with an Intel chip inside. And they've sold around 100 to 120 million units of that particular device, with the 13-inch form factor always the highest volume across the line. That's interesting, isn't it? People like the 13-inch screen. That's very, very interesting. You can buy an M1 MacBook today, a MacBook Pro, sorry, from CX for 470 quid.
So there's another MacBook in there then, I'm guessing.
What would that be?
Is it the MacBook Air?
It is the MacBook Air. Yay! You got it right. MacBook Air. Susie, you've named the number six in our list. Well done. You're doing great. Launched in 2008, Steve Jobs famously pulled it out of a manila envelope. And analysts estimate that around 125 to 150 million of these wafer-thin, beautiful little laptops have been sold, with the 2020 M1 MacBook Air considered the biggest modern era sales surge.
Okay. Yeah.
If you'd like to buy one from CX, would you like to buy one? You can get the M1 variant for 390 quid. So still very valuable and very usable.
Are these on your list? AirPods
on number four. Well done, Susie. They've sold 350 to 400 million units. Incredible, isn't it? Launched in December 2016, the AirPods Pro are the best-selling models in the range, and AirPods revenue has been repeatedly estimated as being in the same scale as Spotify's entire business. Wow, that's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
You can get a first gen pair for as little as 65 quid from CEX.
Number three I'm looking for, is it the iPod range, including like all of the iPods, all the generations and the shuffles and everything?
Number three!
Yay!
With the combined sales across the range, including the Nano and the classic iPod and all the rest of it, 450 million units. So released in 2001, the iPod family sold nearly 450 million units across its lifetime. The Nano was the most common version for mainstream consumers, and it was the bridge product that financially carried Apple right up to the iPhone era. How beautifully done. The Nano 7th gen is still holding its value at 70 quid, is what you'd have to pay for it at CX.
I'm surprised about that.
iPod Classic, 6th gen though, from 2009, you could trade in for 134 quid.
Wow, that's a nice bit of cash, isn't it?
Good luck, Suze, because it's going to get harder now. You're looking for 8, 9 and 10.
Mac in there, the original Mac. Is it the iMac? Was it called iMac?
It is! It's number eight. Well done. The iMac launched in August 1998. That iconic Bondi blue, Suze, you'll definitely remember that. Mm. And they sold roughly 130 million units since launch. And of course, famously, it was the first sort of personal computer once people were having floppy drives, you know, as part of their machines to actually buck that trend.
Yeah.
And as a result of it, the floppy drive kind of died. And you can buy an M1 iMac from CEX for 625 quid.
What about Apple TV?
No, you're right. You got it again.
Is that in there?
You're so good at this. Apple TV arrived September 2006, originally codenamed ITV, until there was a legal pushback, and has sold around 30 to 35 million units, with the HD non-4K model being the most commercially successful generation. Isn't that incredible?
Yeah.
You can pick up an Apple TV for as little as 8 quid, CX. You've got everyone's been a bullseye, but you've got one more to get.
I know, and I'm sort of a bit torn now because I'm not sure whether to go for... I'm going to go for AirTags.
You got it right. No. Unbelievable. Oh, my God. You're like the Apple queen.
Don't say that, people will hate on me for
it. No, they won't. AirTag launched in April 2021. God, as recently as that.
Yeah. Only they're brilliant, one generation. Actually, as well. They're brilliant.
Are they? Well, only one generation, you'll know this. They've sold between 20 and 25 million units. And the technology works because it taps into the world's largest device tracking mesh, namely over a billion active iPhones globally.
Yeah. Of course, they're brilliant for your luggage, which is, you know, what a lot of people buy them for. That was the original sort of idea. People put them on their dog collars. But also, my friend today, so she's put one in her daughter's shoes.
Well, and her daughter,
just in case she gets, like, you know, grabbed. Lost or grabbed or anything like that.
And I thought
that's actually a really brilliant idea.
Do you want to know how much you'd pay 35 quid? Roughly retail, but you can get them for 22 quid at CEX. So that's a good thing, isn't it?
You know, I was getting down to Apple Vision Pro and I thought, no, there's not many of them
sold.
Surely
not. Brilliant. That's 100%. That's extraordinarily well done.
Thank you very much. And that's a wrap for this week's Inbox Edition. Thank you so much for your questions. Please keep them coming. Please keep your stories coming, your gadget humiliation, things that you don't tell your mates, but you can tell us.
Yeah, obviously you can just tell us and then we'll tell the entire world. Yes, if your robot vacuum has tried to escape or your smart speaker is actually a little bit dumb, we want those updates. DM us, tag us or email us at contact@northone.tv with your latest tech madness.
Yeah, and if you haven't already, please make sure that you follow, subscribe, and maybe leave us a review. The Main Gadget Show podcast drops every week with fresh gadgets, reviews, news, and all the other tech nonsense that we can get ourselves into.
Yep, marvellous. That's it. We're done. Over and out. We'll see you next time.
See you soon.
The Gadget Show podcast with Jason and Susie was presented by Jason Bradbury and Susie Perry off the telly. It was produced by Ewan Keel and Tom Clint and is a North One production.